Welcome to Sermon Smith. This is our first ever interview. Sermon Smith is a podcast of conversations about the craft of sermon preparation. And I'm very excited to have my good friend, a preacher I respect very much, for our first guest. His name is J.R. Briggs. J.R., how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on, John.
I like having this conversation, but now I can share it with other people too.
It's a great idea. I'm really glad you're doing this. I'm glad to share, but I'm also glad to be learning with you and from you in this podcast in the weeks to come.
Well, Jarrett, why don't you tell us a little bit about where you are, what you do, what your context is, so we can kind of frame this whole discussion in that.
Yeah, I'm a pastor of a five-year-old church plant here in the Philadelphia area called the Renew Community in Lansdale, Pennsylvania, a suburb about 20 miles north of Center City, Philadelphia. And we meet in a gym. We actually have a very unique structure of meeting every other week, large gatherings. And then the opposite weeks we meet in smaller groupings we call house churches scattered around the region. So it's a unique structure, but we try to structure for mission. But that impacts vastly how we operate and the rhythms in which we sense God's called us to.
Yeah. And so what is your preaching rhythm look like? Do you preach every other week? Because I know you have there's another pastor who's very active in the leadership there.
Yeah, I preach probably about once a month, and he does the other one as well. And then I'm also rotating around teaching in smaller settings with our house churches as well. I do guest preach occasionally or do weekend retreats and things like that when those pop up. But it's just about every other gathering that I'm teaching.
So. Well, I'm going to frame this question not to be answered right now, but I'll be curious as we go through this discussion if you can answer this question, how things differ. Because I know there was a season where you were pretty much preaching every week, mm-hmm. you know, and now you have this. So I'd just love to, even as you're talking through, I know there's some serious benefits to preaching once a month versus once a week, but how you've learned and changed even as you've got this rhythm.
Yeah.
So let's talk then about, you know, the very birth of a sermon. I don't believe you go through the lectionary. So how do you map out, how far in advance do you map out topics? How do you choose topics, texts, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we don't have an actual set time frame, but one of the things that we found is that if we wait the week prior to decide, we're not preparing enough. And we also don't plan a year out feeling like the Holy Spirit is going to probably give us different topics or areas of improvement. Even communities grow and change, and there are areas of need. So finding the sweet spot in the middle, we don't have a set time, but we try to think of it in terms of seasons. And so this summer we thought, what does the fall look like? And we've mapped out all the way until through Christmas. We certainly enter into Advent season, but what does September, October, November look like? And we've mapped that out. We're probably mapping that out about 3 to 5 months in advance, always giving permission to the Holy Spirit to interrupt that as he may see fit to do so. And occasionally we'll break in maybe with a one-off kind of thing that maybe needs to address a particular issue. But right now we have been going through in 2013. We started in January and went through the beginning of the summer in the book of Mark. We're about halfway through Mark, and we'll pick Mark up in the fall and carry that all the way up until Advent. This summer, however, we have been looking at the book of Ephesians, which has been a good letter to kind of break it down to X amount of summer weeks, and each of our elders have taken a different week to teach as well, which has been really fun. We were just talking about that in our elder meeting last night, how rare it is that you see all the elders teaching at some point in churches. Maybe it happens more regularly than I think, but I have not heard that happening much. And I'm grateful we've got good elders who are capable of teaching, and it's good for our community. Even though I love teaching and could do it all the time, I would never get tired of preaching or teaching. It is good to make sure there's a multi-perspectival approach.
Sure.
And we're all bringing our different personalities and bents and passions to the table on that. So normally the rhythm that we have is a book of the Bible and then some sort of topical approach. A book of the Bible, some sort of topical approach. So we do a little bit of a hybrid. Mm-hmm. And we feel both are necessary. So I guess, yeah, January, now that I think about it, January we looked at the theology of work and vocation.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so that was our topic. Then we jumped into Mark. And, you know, so we've done the book of Jonah, and then we talk about glimpses of Jesus. Or we spent a year in Galatians, and then we talked about the parables. It was a little bit more topically driven. So, yeah, we try to balance it out that way, which we feel is pretty important for us to do.
So even when you're talking about topics, though, it sounds like you see topics for you are – there's a level of richness to each of the topics you just talked about.
Yeah, it's never – we never want it to be a proof text opportunity or temptation for us. Sure. But we may do a collection of things like the parables, still rooted in the scriptures, but we may, rather than taking it chronologically, exegetically, maybe like kind of a Calvary Chapel kind of approach, we want to focus on, here are the stories of Jesus. Here's why he tells parables. What are parables he might tell today in our context? So that's what we're focusing on through that window or that lens. But it's still rooted in the text itself.
Nice. It's too bad this is an audio podcast because you had some great gestures there about window and lens that would translate really well.
I speak with my hands. My wife says if you tie my hands behind my back, I won't be able to say anything at all. But it does remind me of something Abraham Lincoln said. He said, when you're presenting, he said, I want to hear a preacher preach with such passion it looks like he's fighting bees. Hmm. And I really like that a lot, that it's got to get inside of me before I can expect to get it inside of other people. And so just that image of Abraham Lincoln seeing a preacher with his hands going everywhere like he's fighting bees. Not that it's in a showy presentation, but that there's got to be a passion about it. So I guess in some ways I fight bees when I talk about things I'm passionate about. So
nice. So this summer then you took a break from Mark to do Ephesians. What was your thinking behind taking a break? You just figure people are in and out, they would lose the rhythm of Mark, or?
Good question. Mark has stretched out a little bit longer than we thought. And so part of it was thinking, even the discontinuity of summers, a lot of people are out,
sure,
vacations and things like that. So we thought maybe it's time for a little bit of a break. And that wasn't something I brought up. That was something our elders and our my other pastor, Doug, he suggested. And so I love the fact that it's a communal approach that our elders speak into that. Doug and myself may go to the elders saying, we really sense moving forward, we should be focusing on this book or this passage or this topic. What do you all think? And they speak into that. Most of the time they affirm that, but they say, you know, I really sense our church is here. And that's what brought about Ephesians. They said, our church is good. We're doing well. And there's growth, but I sense that God wants us to grow into deeper levels of spiritual maturity. And we thought, well, Ephesians is all about that. The theme of Ephesians is grow up, grow up. Mm-hmm. So what does that look like for us as a church to grow up in Christ? How do we do that? How do we equip people to even further levels of health and maturity in Christ, knowing our individual role, but also our corporate involvement and response to God and our calling as a local body of Christ? So that's what generated that. And normally our topics are picked by what are the needs in the community right now? Sometimes it's just straight up biblical literacy of understanding this book of the Bible.
Sure, sure.
You know, let's understand the character of Jesus. We've got a lot of people who maybe have church in their background a long time ago, but it's been a long time since they've been to church. So let's just give them a upfront, clear picture of who Jesus is. Well, Mark does that great. It's a perfect articulation of Jesus up close and personal. Ephesians, we need to grow even further. So a lot of times it's generated by what are we hearing from the Spirit? What are we hearing? What's the chatter we're hearing from people in terms of needs or deficiencies? And us having a general sense of where do we need to grow? What needs do we think need to be addressed? And how might the scriptures address some of those needs as we unpack a particular topic or a particular book?
Yeah.
That's often the thought process in that.
So you talked about you talked about from time to time, you know, you want to be open to the disruption of the Spirit to change a topic and that kind of thing. What's an example of where you've felt a need to do that, and how quickly did you change? Was it like that Sunday or projected a month ahead? Or talk about an example of that.
Yeah, I think the theology of work and vocation was an example of that in January. We uh-huh. started sensing that probably mid to late fall. And said, you know, people are really feeling deficient on how to live out their faith well in their place of work. And part of that was a survey that we had people do, just a quarter sheet, cardstock. It took them 3 minutes, but we asked them, would you fill this out? And before you leave, would you put it in the basket on the back table before we leave? Things like, where do you work? Tell us your place of work. What are ways that this church can equip you in your walk with Christ? How can your elders pray for you? And another one was, the areas I would like to be equipped in the next 6 months are dot, dot, dot. And as we listened and read and prayed through those, what we found was people were saying, I don't know how to share my faith very well. And number two, I don't know how to live for Christ in the workplace. And I just don't know what to do. So they were essentially telling us where they wanted to grow and needed to grow in their journey. And that helped inform this theology of vocation topic and saying, let's do this. So that we sunk our teeth in that and felt like January is a good time to do that kind of fresh start and new perspective that we often bring culturally in on January 1st. So that would be a particular thing. It's hardly a week before. I think one time it was 2 or 3 weeks, but mostly it's a month to 2 months where we say, you know what? In this next season, we really need to address this. Sometimes we break in and just say, man, we've had a lot of people come in. We just need to have a good old fashioned. Here's why we do what we do at our church. Here's the vision of our church and kind of vision Sunday instead of just saying we're going to do that. You know, first Sunday of every year, we do it when we sense, man, it's been a while. We need to remind people who've been here a while. This is why we do what we do. But for new people, because our structure is so goofy, we need to have those regular reminders of why we do it, how it's expressed, and how we arrived at how it's expressed.
So if I go to your church website right now, is it going to say somewhere we have a goofy structure? I mean, is that common terminology?
It's in the vernacular of people. It can be goofy and clunky. It's very different, and I say goofy only because it's so rare.
Sure.
I know there are other churches that do that. I haven't met many of them. But, yeah, it's clunky, but we are at our best actually in times of crisis. And so we thrive at times when crisis occurs, whether it's death or difficult situations, people really rally around one another in that time.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we've talked about how you choose what you're going to preach about. Why don't you walk through, let's dial in maybe on a single sermon and walk through from the point when you know that you're going to be the one preaching that sermon and you know what that topic's going to be. Take us through your process of the very germination of that sermon all the way through to Sunday morning at 8 a.m., before you preach it.
Yeah. Well, I'm always doing teaching prep in my head, whether I'm in the shower or in traffic or falling asleep at night. I'm just wired as a teacher. And so when I hear something on the news or I read a link online or something happens with my kids and I say, man, that would be perfect in some way to implement. So I have a file on my computer where I just dump any idea, thought, creative expression, passage, and I just dump it all on a piece of paper, on a document on my computer.
It's like a Word document?
Yeah, just a Word document. Yeah. And it's just bullet pointed, just splash it all, just vomit all over the page. And I just have found I like to do things way out in advance, and meat tastes better when it marinates. And so for me, I want it to soak in the marinade for a long period of time. Not forever, but more than just a few days.
So this is one document for this particular sermon you know is coming? Not just either, one document of all these ideas you've had?
No, either the series or the particular Sunday. And sometimes I'll have a whole series of, Ephesians, but then I'll say, oh, when we get to Ephesians 4, this particular idea would work really well.
Yeah, okay.
So 2 weeks ago I taught on Ephesians 4 in terms of the fivefold equipper gifting. And that was really important. Well, I had a metaphor that came to my mind where I thought, oh, it's kind of like when all of us are working together in our equipping, it's kind of like field day when you used to have the parachute. In the beginning of Ephesians 4, it talks about one baptism, one faith, one God and Father overall. It's one parachute, but when we're each living out our expressed gifts, we're all taking a corner and pulling and yanking in our direction. Not that we're trying to cut off that part of the parachute and run the other way, but when I'm doing my job and you're doing your job and everyone else is doing their job in their unique gift mix, we're all pulling it. And our church is at its best when that parachute is nice and taut. all the way across. When it's loose and sagging, we're not living up to what we need to. But because there's trust, we're all around the same parachute to pull it tight. Now, that's just a metaphor that came to me because I remember my son had field day and he was so excited about having a parachute. And I thought, oh, perfect. Let me write it down. And just threw it on that document. I let that marinate. I thought through that over a period of time. That spilled out onto the page, but that was a thought that was probably 3 months ago.
Yeah.
That finally came out. And people said, oh, now I get why these gifts are so important to the church. The parachute idea works.
That's a great illustration. It'd be much more fun, though, if it came to you while you were actually skydiving.
Agreed.
And you pulled out a notebook as you were soaring towards the earth and jotted it down.
Agreed. A little unhealthy, but a little unsafe, but and sometimes I'm not near my computer. So I have, my Moleskine that I carry with me. I jot that down, or I may even just pull up my phone and send myself an email.
Yeah.
And it'll say parachute-Ephesians 4, just enough for me to remember. Oh yeah. And then I go back to the document and write it down. And so that's partly just splashing it all on the page. So that marinating stage is just vomiting all over a document of, I'm not assessing whether this is a good idea. I'm just assessing whether it's an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And just throwing it on there. Anne Lamott, in her book Bird by Bird, which is talking about writing, she talks about different types of drafts.
Yep.
She talks about the down draft, where you just put everything down, then the updraft, and you tighten it up. I think about that with sermons too. So I'm in the down phase when it's marinating. Just put it all down. We'll worry about it later if it's any good, but just get it on the page. Then later to go back and tighten it up. So that's that. A few weeks out, I'll actually pull out some,
Let me pause on that though and backtrack.
Yeah.
At some point here, you've already at least read Ephesians 4. So somewhere you've already taken that text to put it in your mind. And Ephesians 4 is obviously a more common text you might have already been familiar with. But, mm-hmm. Maybe when you're working through Mark. So how many sermons do you have in mind that you're trying to cross-reference daily life with? You knew you were doing Ephesians 4, but if you've got 4 sermons coming up, are you able to juggle all those in your mind?
I'm aware of them. They're on the dashboard. And it's not that I'm consciously thinking through them every day, but because they're on the dashboard, if something connects, there's some study that comes out about healing in the New York Times about the benefits of healing or how healing occurs or interviewing doctors. I'll go, wait, we're going to be talking about Jesus healing the mute man soon. Huh. I'm going to throw that link over there because that just lit up on my dashboard.
Great gestures.
So
nobody else is getting the benefit of them, unfortunately.
So yeah, having things way out in the future allow me to have things on the dashboard and then dump it in there and have a parking space where I can park that for a while and then return to that parking lot when I need to.
Yeah.
And that's very, very important to me. So yeah, reading the passage, soaking in the passage, reading it in a lot of different translations is very helpful for me. There's a pastor I know, he won't preach a passage that he hasn't memorized first.
Hmm.
Now that's a huge commitment and one that I haven't been able to make, but I appreciate his willingness to soak in the waters of that passage so much that the fingers of his soles get all pruny because he's been soaking in the water so long.
Yeah.
I can respect that greatly. And so he wants to get in the passage and have the passage get in him because, as I said earlier, how can I expect what I'm about to say to get inside of other people if it's not first inside of me?
Yeah.
So that's gotta be there. And I certainly have some go-to commentaries and key tools that I use that help me immensely with that process. But, marinating process.
Back to those. Because I disrupted you. So that's really the marinating, the downdraft, as you called it, mm-hmm. which I just have to say Bird by Bird is such a fantastic book.
Fantastic.
And it's a book about writing, but it's great for sermon preparation too.
Agreed.
Unless you're easily offended.
You got to understand what you're getting with when you when you read Anne Lamott for sure.
I love Anne Lamott. So, So now you were just before I so rudely interrupted you. You were just about to start talking about then what she calls the updraft when you start pulling all that together. So, let's talk about that. How far before you preach now are we getting to and what does that process look like?
That's about 2 weeks in advance, and there are several – this is where it gets really practical for me. Anybody can dump all the information on the plate, to put everything on a plate, but it's trying to whittle down exactly what needs to be said. That's the, I think the hardest part. That's what I've struggled with in 10 years of preaching. I think that most pastors struggle with, there are 15 good things I could say, but what are the two or three or four best things that I could say? And as we always have that temptation to throw too much in a sermon and go too long and throw too many new ideas at somebody. And so whittling this down, the updraft is the hardest for me to edit out things, because it's like, oh, but I really like that story. It's a good story, but it's not the best story. That's hard. Here are some of the mental tricks that I use. And this is, I my college degree was Christian education. And so these are some of the tricks that we learned in the program. And we just call it heady, hearty, handy. I want to be able to answer questions of the head, questions of the heart, and questions of the hands. And so I'm always thinking through heady, hearty, handy. And the three most important questions: what do I want people to know? What do I want people to feel? And what do I want people to do with what they've just heard? And I want to make sure in my convictions, a good sermon addresses all three of those. And there are times I'll come home and say to my wife, I feel like it was a little flat, my teaching. I can't identify why. And she'll say, you are two out of three. She'll say, you answered the head, what we wanted to know. You told us what we should do, but there wasn't any sort of emotional, inspirational, that's why we do this thing called the church. That's why we're following after Jesus. There are times I can be really informational and really inspirational, and people walk out going, yeah, rah, rah. But they don't necessarily know how to live that out into their week ahead. And when I do that, I fail in that process too. Or I want people to feel something and I want them to do something, but I haven't given them a lot of information. And when you just are acting on emotion, that can be really dangerous, get really dangerous really quickly. So I'm always trying to, I literally will write in the margin of my notes on the left-hand side, heady, hearty, handy, if I'm doing that. So that's the first trick that
alongside
I use.
Alongside the particular point that matches. Yeah, okay.
Exactly. The other thing I'll do is something called HBLT, and hook, book, look, took. And so I go through and say, what's the hook at the very beginning? How am I hooking people in? In the first few minutes, how is my intro drawing them in? And Howard Hendricks once said, when it comes to preaching, take off like a rocket and land like a plane. In other words, unfortunately, oftentimes we take off like a plane and land like a plane. It's also dangerous when we take off like a rocket and land like a rocket. There's just this sudden ending, and it just feels kind of really jarring and awkward. But take off like a rocket, land like a plane. Hendricks also said your loudest sentences of your entire sermon should be your first few, volume-wise. So I try to say, what's the hook? Is it a question? Is it a clip? Is it a thought? Is it a story? Is it something I'm doing? What's going to grip them so that they go from leaning back with their arms folded to actually leaning forward? Like, where is he going with this? I may even provide some strategic uncertainty or strategic confusion. What? Why is he what does this have to relate? I don't And then I want them later to go, oh, that's why he did it. But the hook is really important. Once I hook them in, here's where we're going, here's where we're headed, and then book. And normally that transition from hook to book you can hear is, now turn in your Bibles too, or look at the screen as we read this passage. That's the easily identifiable element of the four. Then after book, let's look at this. Let's unpack this. What does this look like in just understanding what the writer's saying here? And then took, it should be take, but hook, book, look, take doesn't sound very cool. But what's the takeaway? Like, in other words, where am I challenging people to move out with this beyond just listening to this Sunday morning? And so heady, hearty, handy, hook, book, look, took, and I will write those in the margin too, HBLT. And I will actually send those notes ahead of time to an elder or to Doug and say, what do you think? And he may come back and say, your book, look, and took are great. I think your hook is still pretty weak. I think you can sharpen that up a little bit. And so he's actually helping me as he thinks through those categories as well. Howard Hendricks, again, I mean, he's been really practical and punchy with some of the things he has said. And he's one of the best communicators. To be incredibly clear, he said, if it's a mist in the pulpit, it's a fog in the pew. If I'm not being crystal clear on exactly what I'm communicating, if I'm not clear on it, between my mouth and their ears, it's just going to be even more confusing to them. So I'm also asking, what are the illustrations from everyday life? I normally avoid, almost all the time, do I avoid the canned, generic illustrations right. from elsewhere.
Sure.
I'm either drawing it in from culture or in my own life. And if you have kids or a pet, you know that those are perfect. There are tons of sermon illustration material there. And so I'm always looking for that. I'm also thinking through the different filter of life stages. If I'm only telling stories about my marriage or telling stories about my kids, that's excluding people who are single. If I'm only talking about things that guys like, sports or hunting or fishing, I'm excluding half the room, which may not relate. Even sports with guys, not all guys like sports, and I have to keep that in mind. So I'm trying to think through the types of illustrations and metaphors that I'm using and how does that relate. Very practically, in this stage, I do teaching prep in my office for part of it, but location-wise, I also go to a coffee shop. Yes, it's sometimes loud and distracting, but I find that when I prepare in a coffee shop, I am much more clear and sharp on the focus of how does what we're talking about impact the world, quote unquote, out there.
Yeah.
Because I will look up from my teaching prep and see the barista and say, how does what I'm saying here relate to the life of that barista? How does what I'm saying here relate to that guy who's part of a business conversation, or these teenage girls who are texting while they drink their frappuccinos? How are all of these interacting with one another? Does what I'm saying matter? It helps me be that much more focused. Now, when I'm in my office, that's when it's more prayerful. I'll even look at the passage, look at the scriptures and say out loud, as weird as it sounds, say out loud, text, talk to me, speak to me. What do I need to hear in this? And really ask that the Lord would just have things jump off the page, not just what I need to hear, but what I need to communicate and others need to hear. Normally that's in about two chunks of maybe 3 or 4 hours each, one in my office and one out, quote unquote, in the world.
So all of this that you're talking about now, though, this putting together the outline, the heady, hearty, handy, hook, book, look, took, which HBLT, just all that did was make me hungry. So as you're putting, you know, as you're starting to pull all these pieces together, and you talk about you do it in two sections starting 2 weeks out, do you always do that initial starting to pull it together in the quiet of your office, and then part two typically happens in a coffee shop? Are you that deliberate about it, or is it not always that way?
There's no set rule on that, but it does seem to make more sense for me to start out in the quiet, uninterrupted space and then move to the more, you know, kind of fine tuning out, like, how does this story, what illustrations could I use that relate to that businessman, to that barista, to those teenage girls? So yeah, normally that's the process where I start quiet and then go public on that.
Do you, all right, well, I was going to go another direction, but I want to chase this one more. So once you have all of this and you're in the margins, you're writing down hook, book, look, took, heady, hearty, handy, and all that. Are you forming this in an outline? Do you do a manuscript? This is all in the same Word document where you're just deleting the stuff you know doesn't fit?
No, that's an entirely separate document that I'm using. I don't manuscript things. My notes are much more bullet pointed. I will most likely write out my introduction and my conclusion, and I'll normally do those last. Mm-hmm. But they are bullet pointed. Sometimes they're highlighted, caps, italicized, whatever system works for you. But for me, I've found that if there's an illustration, I have it in caps lock and bold, because I may only need to read parachute. Well, I don't need to write out what I know the story. So I just need to see parachute, and then that triggers it for me what's next. If it's more like exegetical, actually teaching on a particular thing, I will bullet point phrases and things like that. And that outline's probably about 3 or 4 pages in length on average. Some people can go extemporaneous, no notes, something. How do you do that? I mean, those people that do that are brilliant. I can't do that. But I'm looking at my notes mostly as reminders of, oh, that's what's next. I'm looking for kind of the next link in the chain. to remind me, oh, parachute, yes. Now, when I'm done with parachute, I may not be able to remember what's next, but I look down and go, okay, yeah. Now, verse 4, it says this. Let's read this. So I'm looking to that to help me just have the links along a giant chain for me, which is, yeah. But I never – the only time I manuscript are funerals and weddings, and that's very purposeful because they seem to carry extra weight. There's an extra sense of formality, and then emotions too. You know, you can get emotional doing a wedding or a funeral.
Yeah.
When I get emotional, I tear up. Maybe it's somebody I know or I see the family mourning and I tear up. When that happens, my brain goes and I lose my train of thought. And so I need that as a way of reassuring me. Even if I don't need it, it's my security blanket just in case my mind goes, especially when every word carries so much weight in a wedding and a funeral. But that's the only time I would manuscript.
And we're going to focus. The whole point of Sermon Smith is more on prep than delivery. But what do you carry into the music stand or the pulpit with you? Do you just print all this out? Do you use an iPad? What do you use for delivery?
Yeah, I normally started with just printing out pieces of paper off my Word document. Then I moved to my Moleskine and actually would cut out, make it fit on a Moleskine page, and tape them actually into my Moleskine. But have moved to an iPad. Just using Pages has become very, very helpful for me. At the beginning I thought, oh, is this distracting? Are people thinking I'm showing off with my little iPad? But now it's become so normal.
Right.
And
it's
practically just to flip up to my notes is so easy to do. I highly recommend it. It took a little getting used to, but I absolutely love it.
Yeah, for sure. I do the same. All right, well then – We talked about how you capture ideas. I said we would come back to some of your go-to resources. You talked about some commentaries, which I understand. As you're going through Mark, you might use different commentaries and that kind of thing. But what are some of your absolute go-to resources that you feel like you're going to turn to every sermon prep process you go through?
Yeah, the first resource I go to are a series of questions.
Okay.
And that's just a way I've self-resourced. One of those we've already addressed, three essential questions: what I want people to know, what I want people to feel, what I want people to do. Other questions would be, what questions do I want them to walk away with? Not just answers, but I want to generate new questions that they're a bit agitated or curious to know more. So what questions do I want them to walk away with? Who will they remember more, the personality of me or the character of God? If they walk away and say, that guy's funny, Jer is brilliant. Wow, he kept my attention. I'm not sure what he talked about, but man, he was really funny. I've missed the point. And so who's getting for the prominence in this? Another one, how can I create healthy tension and unpredictability? How do I get people's butts up out of their seat, not just get their butts and their hearts up out of their seat? How am I equipping and unleashing for mission, not just dumping information? And how can I resource them more if they want to know more? So that's the first tool that I have, are questions like that that I'm asking myself in a self-evaluative process.
At what point are you asking those?
Yeah, I'm asking that by the time I get to the coffee shop.
Okay.
If
it's coalescing, that's when you start to evaluate it. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. If you think about it kind of like a Jell-O mold at the beginning, I'm just mixing in the water and the powder. When I'm up in my office, that's where it's more in a liquid state. But once I get to the coffee shop, that's where it's actually becoming to look like a little bit more of a solid form. By the time I get to Sunday morning, that's when I want to hand out spoons and let people eat. But Saturday night, I will actually go over the process. I will talk it out loud up in my office. I will time it. I think it's going to take 25 minutes, but I timed it. Man, it was 47 minutes. Holy smokes. I got some more cutting to do. That to me is the presentation. What am I going to put the Jell-O on? What plate or what container am I going to put it on to present to people tomorrow morning? That's what I'm worried about.
Do you make Jell-O often?
I don't.
Is this Jell-O metaphor off the cuff, or is this something you've used before?
This is off the cuff.
I'm impressed.
I just made this up right now, so hopefully it works. But once I get past the tool of asking questions, the second one is the IVP Bible Background Commentaries.
Oh,
they have volume 1 and 2. To me, that is my absolute go-to. If I'm stuck on a desert island and I had to preach and could only take a few items, that would be it. Volume 1 and 2.
Is that Old Testament and New Testament?
Yeah.
Yep. I have the New Testament. I love it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And this goes along with the other resource. I spent a semester in Israel, and my experience there is probably one of the best commentaries I have of just being able to see the land, understand the culture. Mm-hmm. Some of my notes that I have from that semester I still pull out and use regularly, because that greatly informs. Because what I want them to understand is, here's what it was like. When Jesus says this story, tells the story, this is what he's looking at. You got this in the north. You got over here. This Israel's the size of New Jersey. Up in the north is the Sea of Galilee. He's on this side of the Sea of Galilee. Here's a picture of it today. Here's a map. So I'm constantly trying to have them enter into that, which makes my Israel experience that much more valuable. And I would recommend any preacher take a week or two trip to Israel, because you will never read your Bible the same, which means you'll never teach the same way again. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually leading a trip in the spring to go over and lead a trip, which is open to anybody. Incoming plug. Sorry, John. If anybody wants to join us on that trip, it is open, and we'd love to have you join us. But that's another one. The Greek English lexicon is another great one, too. I'm not great at Greek, but to have a tool. It's a very old tool I picked up at a yard sale from the 60s, but fortunately the Greek language hasn't changed. The biblical Greek language hasn't changed since the 60s, but it's a fantastic book of being able to say, okay, so for example, when we're in Ephesians 2:10, for we are God's workmanship, mm-hmm. right? To look up workmanship, and the word there is poema,
yeah,
where we get the word poem, right? So being able to toy and play with some of those words. I'm a wordsmith, so are you. So I like to see some of the background, to understand this. It relates to this. It's also used in this passage. And to introduce our church to that brings out more texture and color. So that's a resource that I use. There's a book I just started that's been highly recommended by other great preachers, and it's by Zach. I think you pronounce it Esquine.
I'm reading that right now, too.
Yeah, Preaching to a Post-Everything World, and that's been a viable resource as well. Another book called Partners in Preaching, which I'm forgetting the author's name, but Preaching and Preachers is another one by Martin Lloyd-Jones, which I'm enjoying. My kids, like I said, are always great commentaries on life and ministry and how to live that out. But those are – sometimes it's going with Josephus and reading original documents and things like that. But that's where it gets really, really nerdy on that. But
I can get nerdy. I can get nerdy all day long with you.
Yeah. But another good one too, one more I'll throw in, is the Contemporary Parallel New Testament. And it's actually 8 translations in the same – and it's just the New Testament, but it's the size of – looks like a full study Bible.
Yeah.
But – you know, you open the page. On the left page, there's a quadrant of 4 different translations. On the right page, there's a quadrant. So it may take you 6 pages to get through one chapter. But it's a fantastic thing to say, the way it says it in the New Living, and then the King James and the New King James and the American Standard, the NIV and the Message. When I read that over a period of time, I'm really getting the essence of what's going on here, from very literal to very contemporary, paraphrase-esque in that. And that helps me really get the tone and the flow and the essence of what the biblical writers are trying to say.
What translation do you typically use on Sundays?
It's a good question. I have switched recently to the TNIV, but I am not married to it. One thing, I love the Message. I won't preach out of the Message. I will use it as a stand alongside of whatever, as the way to reinforce, or let's hear it another way in the Message. I try to avoid King James at all costs, simply because we don't talk like that. New Christians, unfortunately, that's what they pick up, because it's free and it's given to them.
Yeah.
And I think we do them a disservice. I do whatever I can to take the King James away from new Christians, because it's hard enough for long-standing Christians to understand.
You have a trade-in program. So.
We just forget trading. We just say we'll buy you one. Let us buy you one. But there's a lot of good ones. NIV, TNIV. Some people in our church use ESV. I mean, that's my home study Bible, is ESV. I like to use different translations, and I don't want to get in a translation war with people. So I'll mix it up. If I have a reader up front with me, which I use sometimes, I will just make sure they're using what I want them to use rather than what they have.
I think that was really even behind the question, was you talk about looking at 8 different translations. So you still kind of stick to one, but you might say, you know, the ESV says this way, and I think that works really well.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Are there other commentary series that you particularly use? You mentioned the IVP. Well, you know what? Let's backtrack to that. IVP Bible background. What is it about that particular commentary that is so precious for you?
Yeah. Understanding what's going on culturally in the passage is so essential to understanding what it looks like in our culture today. And that's why I think that resource is better than any other, because it says, when Jesus shares this, this is what it means. So, for example, I love what the IVP Bible background commentary does with the prodigal son, right? So when he says, you know, kill the fattened calf, put a robe on him, put a ring on his finger, and put sandals on his feet. Well, to us, we think he just wants him clothed. No. You begin to go through in the background of that and say, robes were only worn by royalty. He's treating his son like a king. The ring was the signet ring that you pressed in wax that gave you an identity that you were part of a family. So he's welcoming back as a family. And slaves never wore shoes. Hired hands never wore shoes. Only family members did. So when he's saying put shoes on his feet, he's making a statement.
Sure.
I'm not going to hire him back on as a hired hand. He is my son, and he is welcomed back in the family. Another one was, whoever is the host of a banquet would never, under any circumstances, leave the banquet hall for any reason. So when it says the older son refused to come in, and it said the father left the banquet hall to go speak with his son, in order to speak with his son, it was a disgrace to all of the others who were at the banquet that the host left the room.
So he's showing stuff grace like to that. His older son as well as the younger.
Yeah, and another one, he ran to him. Well, to run to him, the more rich you were, the more influential you were, the slower you walked because you had other hired hands to take care of the needs. So when it says he ran to him, he had to lift up his robe and show his feet, his legs. You didn't do that. That was embarrassing physically to see the bare legs of men in that culture. So that the fact that he runs to his son, he's willing to break cultural expectations and mores, and he's willing to embarrass himself by showing his bare legs to get to the son that he loves. That adds new levels and layers to the story that I wouldn't know if I didn't have the Bible background commentary and other resources like it to help me understand what's actually going on in the story. Then the story in itself becomes a new story. Sometimes the hook that I use is taking 20 minutes to just go through cultural background.
Yeah.
And I tell people, you have that look on your face like, what is he talking about? Where is he going with this? And I said, hang with me. It will make sense. And there have been a few times that for 20 minutes, all I've done is that background. Here are slides. Here's ruins. Here's what it looks like today. Here's a map. This is what's going on when this happens in this culture. And I said, keep all that in mind. And then I said, now let's stand and let's read the passage. Sometimes I can set it up so well on the hook that I can read the book. And when they sit down, they go, oh, wow. And then I don't have to say hardly anything with the look because they get it.
Yeah.
Then I say, okay, now that you know this, what does this have to relate to how we live our lives today? And we'll have a discussion.
Nice.
So that's why that background is so important to me, because if I don't understand what's really going on with the original hearers, how would I expect my hearers to understand those cultural gaps?
Yeah. Yeah. The metaphor I use for that in my mind sometimes is thinking about a frog, because we all dissected a frog in science class, you know, and, you know, there's two ways you can study a frog. You can go see it in its context, or you can put it on the table and get those little pins and the awful smell of
formaldehyde.
There you go. I can recapture that smell just sitting here.
I think we all can.
and yeah, there's something to be said for learning about a frog by cutting it open and all that. But when you can make that frog come alive if you can just set it in its background context or its
yeah,
true context.
Absolutely. That's a great metaphor. That's a great metaphor.
That's not on the fly. I can't pull them out on the fly like you can with the Jello.
But you know, part of preparation too, John, two more things that I want to throw in if it's appropriate. How I pray is incredibly important, and I don't think we focus enough on the prayer preparation. We go, yeah, I prayed. You know, well, what does that mean? Are we committed to prayer on behalf of this? And I had a mentor named Tom Yakeley in Colorado Springs when we lived there. He worked for the Navigators. He's the director of leader development. Great communicator. And he and I would sit down every other week at Chipotle for an hour, hour and a half, and he would just teach me step by step how to communicate God's word. Hmm. And one of the first things he had me do was to memorize 1 Samuel 10:6. He said, I want you to memorize it because when you're about to preach, that's going to come to your mind. And 1 Samuel 10:6 says, and the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you with power, and you will prophesy or you will preach with them, and you will be changed into a different person. And he had me memorize that passage, and that has become my prayer during the last stanza of the last song or whatever is prior to me going up to preach. Yeah. I say, and the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you with power, and you will prophesy or you will preach with them, and you will be changed into a different person. And I say, Lord, for the next several minutes, change me into a different person. And that's the first prayer. And then the second one, the follow-up to that throughout the week, but also right then and there is, Lord, I will do the hard part of getting it from my mouth to people's ears, but you do the harder, more important work of getting it from people's ears to people's hearts. Lord, it's gotten inside of me. I want to steward that well. Lord, would you get it inside of them? Amen. And then by that point, it's probably my time to stand up and get up and begin preaching. But that's the last thing on my mind before I'm walking up front to preach is that prayer.
I feel like you're landing this plane right now, landing the plane of our conversation. But that you did just ask, you know, the next question I was going to go to. You didn't ask. I think you answered the next question I was going to go to, which was, what have we not talked about yet that you want to include? But that would be a great answer to that. But anything else that you feel like we haven't particularly covered this that I think would be helpful to share?
Yeah. There are two things. I guess it relates to one main thing, and that's the idea of the temptations that we always have to fight. And Saturday night in my preparation, there are a lot of temptations I have to work through, address, and defeat before I stand up in front of people. One of those is to be really cute, you know, kind of be cutesy, right? Yeah. To feel like I'm, and maybe that's a temptation to perform, or well, that guy's so genuine, that guy is so. Right. Fill in the blank, and I have to slay the dragon. I have to slay the beast in me that says it's about me and it's not about me. So to be cute, no one's to be brilliant. We all want people to walk away and say, oh my goodness, that guy is so smart, so intellectual, so brilliant. You got to come to my church to hear this guy preach. I got to slay that beast as well. To be funny, there's a temptation to be long-winded, to feel like I have to tell everything and everybody everything I know about this particular topic. Another one is the temptation to be somebody I'm not. We all go in with whoever our go-to preacher is that we've been impacted by immensely, and we just say, oh, if I could just preach like him, or if I could just preach like her, or whatever. And we have to fight that. We can take elements of them and implement that, but finding your voice and who you are, I think, takes a few years. But once you find it, it's still tempting to go off of that towards other people because they're well known or they're very effective. So slaying some of those beasts of temptation is really important. I have to remember the pressure's off. You know, getting feedback from people is good. You know, you want people to like you. You want people to be engaged in the scriptures, and you have a role in that. But I just have to remind myself the pressure's off here. And if I'm starting to feel nervous, there's healthy nervousness and there's unhealthy nervousness. And if the unhealthy nervousness is going towards, oh man, I got to perform, I got to do well, I got to have people like me, I'm missing the point of grace. Yeah, I'm missing the point of preaching the gospel to myself before I communicate this gospel to other people, because it is entirely, the pressure is entirely off. I partner with God. And there are times I'm reminded of this where I think, man, I hit a home run. And, man, wasn't I awesome? It's sort of, unfortunately, embarrassingly what I think and feel. And I'll ask somebody, hey, what'd you think about Sunday? And they'll say, and this is like Tuesday morning, I don't even remember what did you teach on again? I'm like, are you kidding me? That was so good. And you know, and it just slays in me that beast for approval or affirmation or thinking it's about me. At the other end of the spectrum, though, there are times where we've all done it, where we just feel like we've bombed so badly. We're embarrassed and we just want to slither away as quickly as we can and get away from people because we just feel like it was so bad. And yet the Lord at times will bring people, I'll remember those awful ones, and the Lord will bring people in my life that will say, do you remember 6 months ago when you taught on that particular idea? That thought changed the way I view God.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll say, you got something out of that? Are you serious? I didn't even get anything out of that. But God will remind me it's not about you. Don't give yourself so much credit for the good, but also don't give yourself so much credit for the bad. Don't think that I can't work despite you bombing a teaching in that. And I have to remember it's like a meal. I don't remember what I had for breakfast last Thursday morning. But it was important in my growth, health, and development as a human being. Doesn't mean it was inconsequential. I don't remember every meal. I probably don't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday. But it was still a part of my growth. There certainly are times I remember good meals. I remember that anniversary dinner was incredible. Thanksgiving was great. But if I don't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday, it doesn't mean it wasn't important or influential in my health, development, and growth physically. Because without it, I wouldn't be as healthy today. So that helps keep the pressure off and the temptations at bay. But that's Saturday night doing business with the Lord of making sure I'm not just timed it right and the logistics are right and the PowerPoint slides are in order, but also to make sure, is my heart ready to stand before people as a messenger and ambassador on behalf of God who's entrusted me with this particular calling to proclaim the good news to a group of people who are listening.
Well, I appreciate your intention to prepare your soul each week as much as you prepare your sermon. Because for me, you know, I'm certainly deliberate about the prep process of the sermon. And for me, it's easy to forget about the intentional, I need to prepare my soul for this specific sermon and not just see that as an ongoing, you know, practice. So that's good. Two really nerdy questions because I have to get nerdy. All these books that you talked about, sounds like you're using printed books, spreading them out on your desk. You don't use Bible software or anything like that?
I don't use Bible software. For me, for whatever reason, and I do lots of ebooks and I've, you know, my iPad and all that, but I find that I engage more deeply with hard copy books. And so for me, I want to dog ear things and circle things and, if I'm earmarking something, I can do that a lot easier in terms of a filing system when it's an actual hardback book.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't know if I'll ever get away from the teaching prep side being hardback books. Just about everything else I can do digital, but that to me is very, very important to actually, maybe it's what I grew up with, but having something in hand is very important. So, you know, Logos and some of these other ones are really good from what I hear. I just have had a hard time. I use BibleGateway.com if I need to look up or cut and paste a passage here or there, but all of my commentaries are hardback in nature, actual in my possession.
And even nerdier, what specific Moleskine do you use? Hard cover, soft cover, blank pages, lined pages. Well, you can't hold it up. This is a podcast. Nobody's going to see it.
That's true. Well, the smaller size I carry with me at all times that fits in my back pocket of my pants.
He is holding it up for the record.
So I am. And I change it up in terms of sometimes it's lined, sometimes it's squared, sometimes it's blank, sometimes it's the storybook boxes.
Yeah.
So because I use my iPad now, you know, it was the larger – you know, the larger book size one I was using when I would actually paste them in my notes in there. But this one in particular, I just have with me at all times to jot down if I have some particular idea that I absolutely need to, like, I need to get out on paper or I'm going to forget it. I call this the parking space, Moleskine, that I can just perk it in there and go back to so that I remember later.
All right. Sorry, I just have to know.
Of course. You and I keep Moleskine in business, so these are important, significant questions.
I've actually been carrying field notes more often lately. They're the smaller, you know, not butcher paper, but almost cardstock kind of cover. And they just break down, and it just feels good because they feel disposable. But they curve to my backside.
So, yeah, I tried that. I gotta go with the hard ones, but every time I sit down, I pull my wallet and my Moleskine out and put it on the table with me. I just I can't do the curved ones. It gets too beat up. But my boys, when I'm done with it, they always beg me, can I have your old one, Dad? Give me your old one. Give me your old one. So my sons now have all my old moleskins once I've gone through them and no
with
longer.
All the notes in them.
Fun. So they don't mean anything to them, but they just like having a little notebook that they know belonged to Dad. So fair enough.
So, well, I know that you need to go, and we're right about the hour we were targeting. So where are you to be found? If somebody wants to follow what you're up to, your church, your tweets, I assume you want to talk about your blog.
Yeah, you can find me on my blog at jrbriggs.com, though because of these writing deadlines that I'm butting up next to with these two book projects, I have not blogged in quite some time. So you can go there. It won't be very active. But
you'll return to that.
Absolutely. Okay. I will at some point. I don't know to what length or level or involvement, but I will return to that. But there, kairospartnerships.org is the organization which we started. It's another way to kind of find out what we're doing. And then on Twitter, it's JR_Briggs. JR_Briggs. So we'd love to interact with anyone else. And of course, John, our continual interaction there on Twitter as well.
And the church website is?
Church website is renewcommunity.org.
Do you have a podcast? Can somebody listen to how you preach?
We have tried to do that. We've had a couple stop starts on that. We are in an echoey gym. And the podcast picking up on that, it isn't great on that. The other one too is just labor intensive in terms of getting someone who's tech related. Just some of it's logistical. We haven't found a good rhythm with that. But, so it's kind of stop and start on some of that. But we always prepare, and just very briefly, because of our gathering house church model, we give our house church shepherds, our leaders of our house churches, I give them my notes after I've preached it, and I also give them what we call the going further, which is questions, creative ideas, additional passages, practices, additional resources. We just want to resource them to unpack and facilitate conversation further based on what we preached on the week before in the gathering. And so that's another way we try to just resource our people and give that to them. So even though we don't have a podcast, we're trying our best, and that's available. Those are on our website as well. But if anybody wants the going further, my notes or the going further, they can just email me through jrbriggs.com, and I'd be glad to attach an example if people are interested. It may not make sense or it may not understand it because I'm the only one that normally just needs to understand it, but that is available if people desire that. So,
all right. Well, JR, thanks so much. I feel like I knew it would be a pretty safe bet to schedule you for the very first interview because I knew no matter how poorly thought through or developed my questions were, you would come along with some great answers. And so thanks for living up to my expectations for that.
Well, I'm honored that you'd asked me to do it. It's a significant topic, and it's a topic I'm passionate about and love talking about. So I'm eager to hear your future podcast guests to learn alongside of them as well.
Yeah, and I'll go ahead and say this. My next one is already scheduled. I'm going to be interviewing Steve Carter, who is he used to be a teaching pastor at Rock Harbor in Southern California, and now he's a teaching pastor at Willow Creek. So it's going to be a fun one. He's also a longtime friend, so I'm looking forward to it.
Great.
Thanks a lot, JR.
Thanks, John.